Chapter 20. A broad smile crossed Austin's bronzed face as the taxi crunched onto the long gravel driveway in Fairfax, Virginia. Austin paid his fare from Dulles Airport and sprinted up the steps of the Victorian Boathouse, part of an old estate fronting on the Potomac River. He dropped his bags inside the door, swept his eye around the combination study den, and the familiar line from Robert Louis Stevenson came to mind. Home is the sailor, home from the sea. Like Austin himself, his house was a study in contrasts. He was a man of action whose physical strength, courage, and quick intelligence made him a force to be reckoned with. Yet he possessed a cool intellect, and he often drew inspiration from the great minds of centuries past. His work often involved the latest in high-tech gadgets, but his respect for the past was crystallized in the brace of dueling pistols that hung over his fireplace. It was part of a collection of more than 200 sets to which he was always adding, despite the limitations of a government salary. The dichotomy in his personality was reflected in the comfortable dark wood colonial furniture that contrasted with the plain white walls, like those in a New York art gallery that were hung with contemporary originals. His extensive bookshelves groaned under the weight of hundreds of books that included first editions of Joseph Conrad and Herman Melville, and well-worn volumes containing the writings of the great philosophers. While he could spend several hours studying the works and wisdom of Plato and Kant, his extensive music library was heavy on progressive jazz. Curiously, there was little to indicate he spent most of his working days on or under the sea, except for a primitive painting of a clipper ship and a few other sailing vessels, a photo of his catboat under full sail, and a glass-encased model of his racing hydroplane. Austin had lovingly converted the boathouse into a residence, doing much of the work himself. His assignments for NUMA, and before that for the CIA, took him all over the globe. But when his work was done, he could always return to his safe harbor, drop sail, and throw the anchor over the side. All that was needed to make the nautical analogy complete, he reflected, was a ration of grog. He went into the kitchen and poured himself a glass of dark rum and Jamaican ginger beer. The ice tinkled pleasantly in his glass as he threw the doors open to release the musty smell. He went out onto the deck, where he filled his lungs with the fresh river air and surveyed the slow-moving Potomac in the vanishing light. Nothing had changed. The river was as beautiful and serene as ever. He stretched out in a wood-slatted Adirondack chair, lay back, and stared at the sky as if the stars could tell him what was behind the events of the last few days. His misadventures in the Faroe Islands and in Copenhagen would have been the stuff of dreams, if not for the itch on his chest where the knife wound was healing, and the tender swelling under his hair where a club had connected with his noggin. He could draw a straight line from the sabotage of the SOS ship to the attack on a quiet Copenhagen street. The dark impulses that had inspired the sabotage of the SOS ship were obviously a means to an end. Simply put, someone wanted SOS out of the picture. When Austin had got nosy, he'd become a target, first in Skalskown and later in Copenhagen. The situation could be summed up in a simple equation. Whenever someone got too close to a company called Oceanus, the results could be disastrous. His thoughts drifted back to the Faroe Islands fish farm and the thing in the fish tank that had scared the hell out of him. A miasma of pure evil seemed to hang over the Oceanus operation. What had Jorgensen said? Unholy. Then there was the Basque tycoon, Balthazar Aguirre's, and his quixotic quest. What was that all about? Austin went over the events of the past several days in his mind until he felt his eyelids drooping. He downed the last of his drink, climbed the stairs to his bedroom in the turret surmounting the mansard roof, and turned in. He slept soundly and was up and dressed early the next morning, refreshed by a night's sleep and stimulated by a pot of strong Kona coffee. He telephoned an old friend at the CIA to make sure he would be in, then called his NUMA office to say he'd be late. Unlike his colleague Dirk Pitt, who collected antique autos and relished driving them, Austin was indifferent when it came to ground transportation. Driving a sedan from the Numa carpool, nondescript except for its turquoise color, he headed to Langley along a route he knew well from his days with the CIA and parked his car next to dozens of other government vehicles. Security at the sprawling complex was tighter since 9/11. Herman Perez, whom he had called earlier, was waiting in the visitor's area. Perez was a slightly built man with an olive complexion and dark brown eyes that matched his thinning hair. Perez helped speed the check-in process through security and led Austin through the labyrinth of corridors to an office uncluttered by a scrap of paper. The only objects on the desktop were a computer monitor, a telephone, and a photo of an attractive woman and two cute children. "Kurt, it's great to see you," Perez said, motioning for Austin to sit down. "Thinking of jumping Sandecker's ship to come back into the company? We'd love to have you. The cloak and dagger stuff you're so good at has become respectable at Langley once again."
"Admiral Sandecker might have something to say about that, but I'll have to admit that I still get misty-eyed when I think about the fun we had on our last job."
"The secret missile retrieval job we did off Gibraltar," Perez said with a boyish grin. "Oh boy, that was something.
I was thinking about that on the drive over this morning."
"How long has it been?"
"Too damn long.
You know something, Kurt? I still hear little flamenco dancers in my head whenever I drink Spanish wine."
A dreamy look came into Perez's face.
"By God, we had some good times, didn't we?"
Austin nodded in agreement.
"The world has changed a lot since then."
Perez laughed in reply.
"Not for you, old pal. Hell, I read about that amazing rescue you pulled off in the Faroe Islands. You haven't changed a bit, you old sea dog. Still the same swashbuckling Austin."
Austin groaned. "These days, for every minute swashing buckles, I spend an hour at my desk dealing with reports."
"I hear you. I could do without the paperwork, although I've gotten to like my 9-to-5 schedule since I became a father. Two kids, would you believe it? Being a desk jockey isn't all bad. You might want to try it."
"No, thanks. I'd rather have my eyeballs tattooed." Perez laughed.
"Well, you didn't come here to talk about the good old days. You said on the phone that you were looking for background info on Baltazar Aguirre's. What's your interest in him, if you don't mind my asking?"
"Not at all. I ran into Aguirre's in the Faroe Islands. He seemed like a fascinating character. I know he's a shipbuilding magnate, but I suspected there was more to him than meets the eye."
"You met him?"
"He was fishing. So was I."
"I should have known," Perez said with a shake of his head. "Trouble attracts trouble."
"Why is he trouble?"
"What do you know about the Basque separatist movement?"
"It's been around a long time. Every so often, Basque terrorists blow up a public building or assassinate an innocent government official."
"That pretty much sums it up," Perez said. "There's been talk for decades of a separate Basque state that would straddle Spain and France. The most radical separatist group, ETA, started fighting for an autonomous Basque state in 1968. When Franco died in 1975, the new Spanish government gave the Basques more political power, but the ETA wants the whole enchilada. They've killed more than 800 people since taking up the cause. Anyone who is not on their side is an enemy."
"A familiar story around the world, unfortunately."
"The political wing of the separatist movement is the Batasuna Party. Some people have compared it to Sinn Féin, the public face of the IRA. The Spanish government threw up its hands after more assassinations and the discovery of a big ETA weapons cache. Autonomy wasn't working, so they banned Batasuna and started to crack down on the whole separatist movement."
"Where does Aguirre's fit into this bloody little picture?"
"Your instincts were right about there being more to him than meets the eye.
He has been a major backer of Batasuna. The government has accused him of financing terrorism. I liked him. He didn't look like a terrorist, Austin said, recalling his benefactor's bluff and down-to-earth manners. Sure. And Joe Stalin looked like somebody's grandfather. Austin remembered the yacht's tough-looking crew and the heavy-duty armament the vessel carried. So are the charges true? He freely admits to supporting Batasuna, but points out that it was a legitimate party when he gave them money. The government suspects he's still channeling money into the movement. They have no proof, and Aguirre's is too well-connected to bring into court with flimsy evidence. What's your take on the guy? In all my years in Spain, I never met him, which was why I was surprised when you said you had. I think he's a moderate who'd like to see a peaceful separatist solution, but the ETA murders have undermined his cause. He's afraid the crackdown will rekindle the conflict and endanger innocent citizens. He may be right. Sounds like he's walking a very thin tightrope. Some people say that the pressure's made him unhinged. He's been talking about a way to rally European public opinion in favor of a Basque nation. Did he give you any hint of what's on his mind? Perez narrowed his dark eyes. Surely you didn't talk just about fishing. He struck me as very proud of his Basque heritage. His yacht is named the Navarra. He didn't say a word about politics. We talked mostly about archaeology. He is an amateur archaeologist with strong interest in his own ancestors. You make him sound like a contender for the nutty professor. Let me give you a warning, old friend. The Spanish police would love to nail him to the wall. They have no direct proof linking him to terrorist acts, but when they do, you don't want to be in their way. I'll remember that. Thanks for the heads up. Hell, Kurt, it's the least I could do for a former comrade in arms. Before Perez had the chance to start reminiscing again, Austin glanced at his watch. Gotta get moving. Thanks for your time. Not at all. Let's get together for lunch sometime. We miss you here. The brass is still ticked off about Sandecker grabbing you for Numa. Austin rose from his chair. Maybe we'll work on a joint operation someday. Perez smiled. I'd like that, he said. The Washington traffic had let up, and before long, Austin saw the sun gleaming on the green glass facade of the 30-story Numa building overlooking the Potomac. He groaned when he walked into his office. His efficient secretary had neatly piled the pink callback slips in the center of his desk. In addition, he would have to dig himself out of an avalanche of email messages before he got down to preparing a report on the sea lamprey tests. Ah, the exciting life of a swashbuckler. He scrolled through his email, deleted half of it as non-essential, and shuffled through his pink slips. There was a message from Paul and Gamay. They had gone to Canada to check into an Oceanus operation. Zavala had left a call on his answering machine saying he would be home that night in time for a hot date. Some things never change, Austin thought with a shake of his head. His handsome and charming partner was much in demand among Washington's female set. Austin sighed and began to work on a report of the Oceanus adventure. He was wrapping it up when the phone rang. Good afternoon, Mr. Austin. I was hoping I'd find you in your office. Austin smiled at the sound of Therry's voice. I'm already pining for the high seas. Your flight home on the Concorde went well, I trust. Yes, but I don't know why I hurried back. My inbox is filled with depositions and briefs. But I didn't call to complain. I'd like to get together with you. I'm halfway out the door. A walk, maybe. Cocktails and dinner. Then, who knows? We'll have to put the who knows on hold for now. This is business. Marcus wants to talk to you. I'm really starting to dislike your friend. He keeps getting in the way of what may be the love affair of the century. This is important, Kurt. Okay. I'll meet with him with one condition. We make a date for tonight. It's a deal. She gave Austin a time and place for the meeting. Therese's charm notwithstanding, he had agreed to talk to Ryan because he had come to a dead end and thought he might learn something new. He hung up, leaned back in his swivel chair, and laced his fingers behind his head. It was easy to bring his thoughts around to Oceanus. His chest ached when he raised his arm, and the pain made an effective memory aid. He wondered if the Trouts had turned up anything. They hadn't called since leaving their message. He tried to reach them on their cell phone and got no answer. He didn't worry. Paul and Gamay were fully capable of taking care of themselves. Next, he called Rudy Gunn, Numa's assistant director, and set up a luncheon meeting. Rudy's famed analytical skills might help guide him through the dense thicket surrounding the mysterious corporation. Gunn was bound to home in on Aguirre's, questioning whether there was any link between Basque terrorism and Oceana's violence. Aguirre's had mentioned his ancestor, Diego. Austin pondered the Basque's obsession with his forebear and thought that Aguirre's might be onto something. From his own experience, Austin knew that the past is always the key to the present. He needed someone who could guide him back 5 centuries. One person came to mind immediately. Austin picked up the phone and punched out a number.